Hello, and welcome back to another episode of In Summation, The Final Word, a podcast for inquisitive minds on real courtroom drama. Before we get into today's episode, I actually need to do a tiny bit of housekeeping. For anyone who actually looks me up, the name of my law firm has changed. When I recorded the previous episodes, I was working for Gottlieb & Janey. The firm is now Robert C. Gottlieb & Associates. So if you're curious about me, as always, you can reach out to me at insummationpodcast@gmail.com or read up a bit about me on my firm's shiny new website, robertcgottlieblaw.com. Now that that's taken care of, let's get into today's case. What do you think of when you hear the name Al Capone? Bootlegger? Scarface? Gangster? Weaponizing the Tommy gun? Violence? Mayhem? Destruction of societal norms? What about tax evader? Did you know that even with all the death associated with Al Capone, the only reason he was sent to Alcatraz prison was for failing to pay his taxes? Television shows like Boardwalk Empire and movies like The Untouchables and Road to Perdition recreate facets of Capone's life. But how accurate are they, or do they even try to be? These are fictional accounts of one of the most notorious men to have ever lived in America. The intent to present him as larger than life to tell a story is to get eyes on the screens rather than to convey the truth about this man's life. And the truth is, for all the blood that Capone spilled, whether directly or indirectly, for all the illegal alcohol he transported and sold during Prohibition, the federal government had trouble ever making anything substantial stick to him. And what finally did him in, how they finally put an end to the reign of Alphonse Capone, the most vicious gangster in Chicago's heyday of organized crime, was bookkeeping. Al Capone went to trial in federal court for failing to file his income taxes. But to understand what happened during that 12-day trial in October of 1931, we have to go back much earlier into Capone's life and see what events actually led to that courtroom. Despite being routinely tied to organized crime in the Chicago area, Al Capone was actually born in Brooklyn to immigrant parents on January 17, 1899. His father was a barber, his mother was a seamstress. He had 8 siblings, one of which actually grew up to be a prohibition agent enforcing the Volstead Act, who actually had to change his name from Vincenzo Capone to Richard Hart because of the associations with the Capone name. There's not a whole lot known about Capone's early childhood. We do know that he was a bright student, but was expelled from Catholic school at 14 when he punched a nun in the face. He worked a few odd jobs, one stocking a candy store, another time he manned a bowling alley. And from 1916 to 1918, he was a semi-professional baseball player. It was around that time that Capone was playing semi-pro ball that he also started dabbling in organized crime. Most historians seem to agree that this is also around the time when he got the famous scars on the side of his face. Capone hated the scars. He refused to be photographed on that side his entire life, and he was extremely tight-lipped about how he got them. There are several stories circulating about them, some more far-fetched than others, but as I was looking deeper into the history of Capone, I came across a news article from the Brooklyn Daily Times from December 9, 1918. The very short article detailed how an Italian-American man named Alfonso Capone, around 20 years old at the time and living at 38 Garfield Place, which was indeed his Brooklyn address, was slashed in the right cheek by 2 men. Nothing more is really said in the article. It could have been a random attempted robbery. It could have been a rival organized crime gang who targeted Capone for some reason. He had already made inroads in his criminal career at that point. We really don't know for sure. And while I came across several widely varying accounts while doing research for this podcast, as I've mentioned before, I try and stay away from rank speculation and focus on what is verifiable and what we actually know. And all that's really known is that Capone was slashed on the right side of his face and remained self-conscious about it for the rest of his life. 3 more significant events happened in Capone's life at the end of 1918. First, his son Albert Francis Capone is born. He's affectionately referred to as Sonny. Second, he gets married to May Josephine Coughlin, Sonny's mother. The wedding takes place immediately after Sonny is born. From every account that I've uncovered, despite Capone's criminal proclivities, he and May remained married throughout his entire life, and she stuck by him through everything. Third, Capone met a man by the name of Johnny Torrio, who would forever change the course of his life. Torrio was an enforcer for crime boss James Colosimo, called Big Jim, in Chicago. In 1919, Capone moved his family to Chicago on Torrio's invitation. His first job with Torrio was working as a bouncer in a brothel. While working in this house of prostitution, he somehow managed to contract syphilis. Believe it or not, syphilis was actually quite treatable back in 1920. Nobel Prize winner Elie Metchnikoff had discovered Salvarsan back in 1909, which was an effective medication. Salvarsan is actually a portmanteau for saving arsenic and was the preferred method for treating syphilis until the advent of penicillin. However, Capone never sought treatment for the disease. Capone and Torrio became very close, and Torrio was bringing Capone deeper and deeper into Big Jim Colosimo's organization. On May 11, 1920, Big Jim Colosimo was assassinated. Johnny Torrio became the new head of his criminal empire. Rumors abounded at the time that Capone was involved in the assassination, but that's never been conclusively established. With Torrio as the head, Capone became his right-hand man. By now, Prohibition, or the Volstead Act, was in full swing. It was passed in December 1917 and took effect the following year. The outlawing of alcohol immediately created an extremely lucrative black market for any and all intoxicating liquors. By the early 1920s, organized crime syndicates had staked out their bootlegging territories, and Chicago was a prime example of how deadly wars over these territories could happen. Johnny Torrio held himself out to be a man of diplomacy in these troubled times, but when he was asked to mediate a territorial dispute between the Northside Gang, run by Irishman Dean O'Banion, and another Italian outfit run by the Jenna brothers, Torrio balked. O'Banion, who was complaining of encroachment into his Northside territory, became quite vocal in his criticism of Torrio. And in response, O'Banion was murdered in his flower shop in 1924. Jaime Weiss took control of the Northside Gang and swore to get revenge against Torrio. In January of 1925, Capone himself was ambushed. He escaped unhurt, but 12 days later, his boss and close friend Johnny Torrio was shot multiple times. Torrio survived, but saw the writing on the wall. He resigned and handed the entire operation over to 26-year-old Al Capone. While Torrio considered himself a gentleman and a man of diplomacy, Capone's philosophy was that violence was an effective tool to increase revenues. Capone's rule was simple. He would approach an establishment which he knew was purchasing liquor. He would demand that they only purchase from him. If they agreed, they would be protected from raids by Capone's control over significant sections of local law enforcement. But if they declined, he would place a bomb in their building and blow it up. In the 1920s, Capone was responsible for Chicago bombings, which killed approximately 100 people and destroyed countless buildings. Capone eagerly sought out the spotlight. He was rarely seen in public without flashy clothing and glitzy jewelry. He spent a lot of time in jazz clubs. He even gave several interviews. He would frequently describe himself as just a simple businessman, giving the people what they want. He became a national figure, but somehow it seemed nobody could touch him. Capone had become so powerful that he was able to move to Cicero, Illinois, a Chicago suburb, and take over the entire town council. He never had title to property in his name. He never in his whole life had a bank account. And while heading his criminal organization, he lived in the Hawthorne Inn in Cicero, in a room he paid for in cash. By the beginning of 1929, Capone was heading Chicago's most powerful organized crime outfit, basically unchecked, for 4 years. He had built political power with the mayor of Chicago, William Thompson, and he was paying off Chicago police officers to ignore his bootlegging and sometimes to even protect his shipments. He has real power. Things changed on Valentine's Day in 1929. Some of Capone's men disguised themselves as police officers, claimed they were conducting a police raid of the headquarters of his rivals, the Northside Gang. Seven men were taken outside and lined up, believing that Capone's men were there to arrest them. They were then executed with machine guns and shotguns on the sidewalk and left for dead. The Valentine's Day Massacre soured the public on Capone, and unsurprisingly, his reputation took a substantial hit. Herbert Hoover had just become sworn in as president a few weeks earlier, and following the Valentine's Day Massacre, Hoover directed federal law enforcement to focus on Capone's activities, to rein him in and bring him down. A multi-agency response was coordinated. One prong of this was the Untouchables. Prohibition agents led by Elliot Ness, who were said to be uncorruptible, could not be bribed. They focused on the bootlegging aspect of Capone's operation and had some success. Capone was summoned to testify to a grand jury investigating violations of prohibition laws. It seemed that federal agents were finally beginning to crack down on his organization, but very little ever materialized on that front. Capone had other minor legal battles. He served 9 months in Pennsylvania after pleading guilty to a concealed weapons charge. He was arrested for vagrancy in Florida, then for perjury on his testimony in the federal grand jury, and then contempt when he refused to testify again. Each of these minor infractions just saw Capone returning stronger than ever. Now, enter onto the scene Assistant Attorney General Mabel Walker Willebrand. It was estimated, based on analysis of Capone's operation, that he was worth around $30 million in 1929. Mabel Willebrand had been following Capone and other gangsters, seeing that they lived lavish lifestyles, had fancy clothes, new cars, jewelry, gambled heavily, losing frequently, and yet never filed any tax returns showing where any of this money was coming from. The Treasury Department decided to use a bootlegger by the name of Manly Sullivan as a test case. Sullivan was arrested and charged with failing to file tax returns showing profits from his illegal business. Ultimately, the deciding issue of the case went all the way to the Supreme Court, who determined that the Fifth Amendment protections against self-incrimination did not extend to tax return filings. Often, prosecutors and career government employees are not known for their creativity. But Mabel Willebrand bucked that trend in a huge way. Figuring out a novel way to charge Capone with substantive crimes was a Herculean task, but she thought outside the box and came up with a truly brilliant idea. With the Manly Sullivan conviction secured and the necessary legal precedent set, President Hoover immediately instructed his Treasury Secretary, Andrew Mellon, to go get Capone. The head of the Treasury's Special Intelligence Unit selected Frank Wilson to investigate Capone. Wilson had no trouble finding purchases and receipts showing outrageous expenditures, but Capone had no bank account. It was impossible to draw any direct links between proceeds from illegal activities and Capone's pockets. Wilson and his team decided that to build an airtight case against Capone, they would need to flip an insider who had knowledge they could exploit. Now, they probably could have brought a case against Capone with the circumstantial evidence of his spending and argued to a jury that they could infer that the money came from illegal sources. But Wilson refused to greenlight the case until he was entirely certain that they could not lose. Even back in the 1930s, juries wanted direct lines drawn from A to B to C. A prosecutor couldn't just say, well, everyone knows he's running these gambling and liquor operations, so that's where the money's from. The chance of a high-profile loss at trial was too great. On top of that, Capone controlled so much of Chicago and its suburbs that they knew they were already going to be fighting an uphill battle, and no missteps could occur. For obvious reasons, not many people with intimate knowledge of Capone's organization were willing and eager to speak with law enforcement. But luck was with Wilson, and he was able to find one Eddie O'Hare. O'Hare was the man who had built and patented the mechanical rabbit used at the Greyhound racetracks, and he ran the racetracks for Capone in Chicago, Florida, and Massachusetts. As an aside, Eddie O'Hare had a son named Edward O'Hare, who was the first naval aviator to win the Congressional Medal of Honor. Chicago's International Airport is actually named for him. But back to Eddie O'Hare. He provided leads to Wilson, which they used to conduct raids. One of those raids led to the seizure of a ledger with references to gambling and certain amounts and figures. Wilson's team was able to take those ledgers and match the handwriting to deposit slips from local banks. This led them to a man named Leslie Shumway. Shumway, after being threatened with a very public subpoena, decided to talk and linked Capone directly to the gambling business. The agents had him sign affidavits and immediately put him into protective custody. Here's where things get interesting with respect to Capone's actual trial. Without knowing that Shumway had been flipped, Capone had gone to his lawyer, a man named Lawrence Mattingly, to approach the government with a proposal. He had heard that he was being investigated over his taxes, so Mattingly met with Frank Wilson to discuss Capone's tax liability. The story goes, Mattingly came to the meeting, took a letter out of his coat, threw it on Wilson's desk, and told him that this was the very best Capone could do. The letter very clearly conveyed an amount of money that Capone was offering to pay in order to cover his unpaid tax liability. It also admitted certain income for the years 1924 to 1929. Wilson balked, and neither Mattingly or Capone was pleased. Wilson continued his quest and managed to identify another key witness, Fred Rice, who was the named recipient of multiple cashier's checks, which Rice confirmed made their way directly to Capone. Like Shumway, as soon as he agreed to cooperate, he was stashed far away from Chicago in protective custody. When Wilson had what he felt was the best case he could possibly bring, he ran to the federal grand jury. With only 2 days remaining on the statute of limitations concerning any potential charges relating to tax evasion from the year 1924, the government secured an indictment. They then added counts for the years 1925 to 1929. When the indictment came down, Capone's lawyers contacted the U.S. attorney to try and secure a deal. If you recall previous episodes when we briefly discussed federalism and the difference between the state courts and the federal courts, you'll remember that each United States attorney deals with a specific district. In this case, the United States attorney covering the Chicago area is the representative for the Northern District of Illinois. Issues related to the payment of federal income taxes are handled by federal prosecutors. So Capone's attorneys, including Mattingly, meet with George E.Q. Johnson, the United States attorney for the Northern District of Illinois, and they try to work out a deal. For obvious reasons, Johnson is exceptionally nervous about both meeting Capone and the case in general. Having to keep multiple cooperating witnesses safe and rely on their testimony against someone who is proven to have an affinity for violence and a real desire to punish disloyal compatriots was understandably unnerving. Johnson was willing to make a deal for 2.5 years to cover the delinquent tax filings. Capone's lawyers readily agreed. On June 18, 1931, Capone appeared in federal court before the Honorable James Wilkerson and entered a guilty plea to tax evasion on an agreement that the sentence would be 2.5 years. Judge Wilkerson adjourned the case for 6 weeks to consider whether or not he would accept the plea. In federal court, even if the prosecution and defense attorneys agree on a plea, the judge still has to accept it. And judges have the ability, although they rarely use it, to decline to take a plea and force the parties to go to trial. In the 6 week period that followed, Capone, always eager to spend time in the spotlight, complained that he was being singled out, while bankers who lost people's life savings in the great crash of 1929 were all going free. In response, Judge Wilkerson rejected the plea deal and put the case over for trial. Roughly 2 weeks before the trial was set to begin with jury selection, Eddie O'Hare notified Frank Wilson that Capone's organization had obtained a complete list of every person who was slated to be in the jury pool and was passing out money for them and promising them cushy jobs for their support. George E.Q. Johnson notified Judge Wilkerson, but the judge seemed unconcerned and told the parties to be ready for jury selection as planned. On October 5th, 1931, the jury commenced, just as Judge Wilkerson had said it would. All the parties were present, Judge Wilkerson took the bench, and the panel of potential jurors was brought in. As the jurors glanced knowingly at Capone and his bodyguards, Judge Wilkerson called to the bailiff and commanded him to swap all the potential jurists in this case with another judge down the hall who was also set to begin a trial that day. The entire panel was swapped, and the parties began jury selection with the new panel. Ladies and gentlemen, in all of my years of trial work, I have never heard of a judge doing this. It was a brilliant move by Judge Wilkerson to ensure that the trial would be conducted by fair and impartial jurors. But it also underscored his understanding of just how much control Capone had. Judge Wilkerson was provided no hard evidence of Capone's influence over the potential jurors. He was simply told that Capone's people had the list and had been in touch with them. And that was enough for him to make the jury swap. Now, the trial was underway, but as you can imagine, it did not have the start that Capone was expecting or wanted. Capone's lawyers had banked their entire trial strategy on being able to influence the jurors into acquitting Capone regardless of what evidence was presented. With that strategy off the table, they had to rely on arguments that the evidence was insufficient to show that Capone was the direct recipient of an illegal income for which he had failed to file taxes. Despite the very high-profile nature of this case, the prosecution only called 8 witnesses total. They established that Capone had not filed any tax returns, that federal agents had raided the gambling establishments where alcohol was served, and Shumway confirmed that Capone ran these establishments and received their profits and proceeds. There was also testimony that Capone's Florida residence was transferred to his wife's name, and then Fred Reese testified about Capone's direct association with the gambling halls and receipt of their money. But the key piece of prosecution evidence, the linchpin that really tied the entire case together, was Frank Wilson's testimony about the letter that Lawrence Mattingly had given him, in which Capone had essentially admitted that he hadn't paid taxes, but that he had had income, and offered to provide the government with a certain sum of money to cover the liabilities. Without reading the whole letter, it certainly clearly indicated that Capone had income, that he admitted that he hadn't paid taxes, and set out what he was willing to pay. Naturally, the defense objected to the letter coming in, or any testimony about it, and made valid arguments. Capone's attorney, Albert Fink, argued to Judge Wilkerson that a lawyer cannot confess on behalf of his client, and that Capone cannot possibly be thought to have given Mattingly authority to outright confess to a crime. The prosecution argued that the letter was not being offered to show the factual amounts that Capone owed in back taxes. In fact, their position was that he owed significantly more than what he had admitted to in the letter. Rather, the letter was being offered to the jury simply to show that he had made the statements, essentially that he had made an admission. After hearing argument on both sides, Judge Wilkerson decided to admit the letter and testimony about it and allow the prosecution to read the letter to the jury for a limited purpose. Judge Wilkerson instructed the jury that they could consider the letter as proof that the statements contained therein were made, but not as proof of the veracity of the statements. Having used their 8 witnesses to solidify their narrative, the prosecution rested. They had brought out testimony that Capone spent extravagantly, that he admitted to being the owner of gambling halls that had been raided, that he had acquired property and put it in his wife's name, that he kept ledgers on the intake of his illegal liquor vendors and gambling halls, and that he personally received cash from all these establishments. It was clean, it was succinct, it was compelling. The defense called 2 witnesses. 2 bookies testified that Capone lost a lot of money while gambling on horses. So much money, in fact, that it offset any earnings that any of his businesses made during those years. This defense is barely even worth mentioning, as even in the early 1930s, gambling losses would only offset gambling winnings in terms of tax liability. So even if everything that the defense witnesses had said was true, it would not have been a real legal defense to the charges. 5 different people delivered closing arguments in the case. The first was from Jacob Grossman, who argued for the prosecution. He pointed out that even if the jury credited the defense witnesses, Capone lost at a minimum $217,000 in 1924 to 1929 without any stated income during that time period. The second, again for the prosecution, came from Samuel Clausen. He pointed out that Capone was told with no uncertainty that he was free to speak with Wilson about his tax liabilities, but that anything he said would end up being used against him. And that even after that conversation, Capone had come back with the Mattingly letter and offered to pay a paltry amount for his back taxes. Clausen told the jury to consider someone who was speeding and was pulled over, who immediately said to a police officer, "I don't want this used against me, but I was going 50 miles an hour in a 25-mile-an-hour zone." He asked whether that person should be allowed to later deny that he had exceeded going 25 miles an hour. Albert Fink gave the first summation for Capone. He railed against the government for using the tax case as a front. He claimed the government just wanted to get rid of Capone, but had no evidence regarding anything they actually wanted to pin on him, so they were using the tax case as a means of oppression. Fink claimed the government had failed to produce any real evidence that Capone had actually received an income. Capone's other lawyer, Michael Ahern, went even farther, accusing the government of trying to convict Capone because he had become a Robin Hood figure to the masses, making the government look bad for not doing enough to end the Depression. George E.Q. Johnson, the U.S. attorney for the Northern District of Illinois, gave the final rebuttal summation. He impressed upon the jury the sincerity of the government's motives and the importance of taking the tax law seriously. Everyone knows how the trial ended. Capone was found guilty and was sentenced to hard time. Deliberations took a mere 8 hours, and less than a week later, Judge Wilkerson held the sentencing and gave Capone 11 years. This was by far the longest sentence for tax evasion ever handed down. Capone first went to a prison in Atlanta, but then was transferred to Alcatraz. In November of 1939, after serving less than 8 of the 11 years of his sentence, he was released due to his affliction with paresis caused by years of his untreated syphilis. His mind deteriorated, and he regressed back to the mental state of a 12-year-old. He died at the age of 47. In summation, my hat goes off to Mabel Walker Willebrand, who recognized that there are only two things in life which can be relied on 100% of the time: death and taxes. Prior to her suggestion, nobody had any idea how to actually tie Capone to criminal activity. No witnesses would come forward, and there was never any physical evidence tying him to a crime of violence or bootlegging. She really paved the way with creative thinking to convict Capone of something that would actually stick. The prosecution team in this case was also dogged, refusing to settle for anything less than enough to bring a case to court flawlessly. They worked tirelessly to ensure that they not only had enough, but they had enough to erase any doubts whether or not Al Capone had an income he did not pay taxes on. Capone, for all his savvy in running a criminal organization, was clearly ill-prepared to actually try a fair case. He put all his eggs in the jury tampering basket, and when that failed, his defense was paltry. For all his money, when it came down to it, his high-profile spending, gambling, and general lifestyle so far beyond what the common man could ever hope to achieve really solidified the prosecution's argument. Like so many defendants, he ended up being his own worst enemy in the courtroom by what he said and did in his public persona. That being said, I think you would be hard-pressed to find anyone who thinks Al Capone got a raw deal for being prosecuted for tax evasion. Well, ladies and gentlemen, this is the show for this installment. I hope you got as much out of this dive into the legal troubles of Al Capone as I did in researching it. And before I turn off the recording, I just want to say, this is the first recording that I've done after I began actually publishing these episodes. The previous episodes were sort of recorded in a vacuum. But since I started actually making them available to the public, I am deeply touched and grateful to so many friends and family members who have listened and provided feedback. Most of it was very positive. A couple people have had suggestions for improvement, which I also welcome. So now that the show is actually up, I invite any listener to subscribe and follow. Get notified when I post a new episode. I'm trying to get one out every other week or so. I still do have a full-time job, which does take priority. So it's all time permitting, but I do my best. But I do want to say a very special thank you again, especially to my wife, Serena, who has been wildly supportive of this idea, and to my niece, Lizzie, who is one of the first listeners. It really does mean a lot to me. If anyone else has feedback about the show, or if you have a case you suggest we look into, you can reach me again at insummationpodcast@gmail.com, or locate me through my firm's website, Robert C. Gottlieb Law. Until next time, I'm Paul Townsend. I hope you enjoyed this In Summation episode on Al Capone. Thanks for stopping by, and I hope you'll come back for more.